Welcome. You found the Love Mentalism Podcast, a podcast hosted by author Michael DeCamp that focuses on exploring, discussing, and promoting the deep concepts and practical application of biblical love. We hope you enjoy this episode and are challenged to learn to love more deeply. Jesus taught us and showed us the way. It's up to us to learn how to follow it. If more and more of us can do that, we will change the world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Love Mentalism Podcast. I'm your host, Mike DeCamp, and I am here today. I've actually got a special guest, which I'll tell you about in just a moment. So it's so cool to be back with you guys, and I hope that you get a lot out of what we're going to do today. But as you know, as I start most of my podcasts off with I guess I call it a love moment of the podcast. And the one this time, this was a little bit of a personal thing, but right after I recorded the last podcast, I went off to California for a week. I went to San Jose in the Bay Area for, about a couple of days. And then I went down to Orange County in LA for a couple of days before flying home on Friday. And one of the cool things I got to do is I have nieces in San Jose area. And so when I go there, I often try to see them. And I've been going there some the last year. And they have teenagers. So by the way, my friend Thaddeus Starziak is here. And so hi, Thaddeus. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
We'll get more with Thaddeus here in just a couple of minutes. But I went out there, and so Sunday afternoon, I flew in, and my two nieces picked me up at the airport. They're twins, by the way. And so I got picked up at the airport, and then we all went out to lunch, including their kids, which are teenagers. And the cool thing was, and this is what moved me, this is like what makes it the love moment for me this time around, is the three teenagers just abandoned whatever plans they had for that afternoon to come and spend time with Uncle Mike when he comes in. I'm not even their mothers are my nieces. So they're my great nieces. I'm like their grandpa's uncle. So or grandpa's brother. I'm their grandpa's brother. And the fact that they gave up their Sunday afternoon to spend it with me just was a super special thing. So I thought I would share that as my love moment of the episode. So with that, let's just shift over to my friend Thaddeus, who's sitting across the table from me. And you may or may not recognize his name. I think he's known he's known by a little different name.
Yeah, Tad on the show.
Yeah, so
Thaddeus is the full name.
Yeah, so he prefers Thaddeus, I think, in life, but he goes by Tad on a TV show. So Thaddeus is the demo guy. He refers to himself as the demo god.
Yes.
On social media. And he's the demo guy on the TV show Good Bones, which is featured on HGTV. I think there's going to be a new episode or a new season coming out fairly soon, although yeah. I'm not sure we know when yet.
Probably sometime mid-June, I'd say.
Okay.
Mid-June, it'll probably start airing again.
Yeah, I know a lot of people will be excited about that. So, but Thaddeus has been here before. He's been on my other podcast, the Cutter's Notch podcast. We had him on, I think the episode aired around Christmas time, give or take, a couple of weeks of 2021.
Yeah.
And you know, I had him on because of his affiliation with Good Bones. And the cool thing is we got to know each other a little bit. We had some great conversations. And also during the podcast, he shared some really, I guess you'd say really deep personal kind of stuff. And it's right up the alley of what this podcast is all about. And so I wanted to invite him to come back and tell his story. He has embraced the concept of love in his life in a very deep way. It infuses much of what he does on his day-to-day life. It infuses what he does on social media. And he's even gone so far to start an apparel company called Love Heals, because that's exactly what happened with him. I won't even try to tell the story. I'm just going to let Thaddeus do it. But welcome to the show, Thaddeus.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was really fun doing the Cutter's Notch podcast with you, and I'm super amped to be talking about love today.
Very good. Very good. So maybe for those, there may be some folks out there who don't really know Good Bones and they don't know what you do. Is there anything, just as a point of introduction?
Yeah.
Can you tell them a little about who you are, what you do? I kind of did some of that, but maybe touch on some stuff I didn't say.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, my name is Thaddeus Starziak. I go by Tad on Good Bones. We are currently wrapping up season 8 of Good Bones.
8 seasons.
Yeah, 8 seasons. It's crazy. It's almost been an entire decade of my life, from like 20 to almost 30. I'm 29 and I'll turn 30 in September. So almost a whole decade of Good Bones, which is a home remodeling show based out of Indianapolis. And we take old homes, we typically gut them, and then we make them anew, but we try to keep some of that characteristic of the old that was there and try to respect that. But I grew up on the west side of Indianapolis, near like Eagle Creek Park, went to Carnal Ritter High School. I've always been very athletic, always been an avid reader, lover of animals, and yeah, just big lover of life and people and the experience that life is.
And Lord of the Rings.
And Lord of the Rings. Oh my, how did I forget that? Yeah, I'm a huge Lord of the Rings nerd. I think Tolkien is an insanely talented author, philosopher, poet, writer, like just all around amazing guy. I mean, he created languages, you know, that you can actually speak. So that's pretty impressive.
It is. It's even better than Klingon.
Yeah. Exactly. In my opinion, I don't want to offend anybody.
Yeah, I don't want to offend the Trekkers out there, but it's even better than Klingon, I think. It's more intense, definitely.
Yeah,
and absolutely. More in depth. So when you were on before, and I didn't know you then. I mean, you walked into the house, I should say, you know, what I refer to as the Cutter's Notch Studio at the time.
Yeah.
Now it's the Love Mentalism Studio today, but you walked in and it was the first time for us to meet. And, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I thought, you know, here's this guy that he's on the show. He loves to knock chimneys off of roofs and break the gutters off and
crazy stuff.
Rip cabinets out and jump through plaster and, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff. All the various the antics that make you who you are on the show. And so you kind of get the feeling that this is who you're talking to. But in reality, you have a much deeper story to tell.
Yeah.
So
yeah, absolutely.
With that said, where does that story start?
Yeah. So I'm currently 29 now. And I guess, you know, when you're looking at the story of your life, you kind of trace it back all the way to the first thing that you can remember. You know, so when I could start remembering things, I already knew that like my parents' relationship wasn't that great. They were divorced shortly after I could start remembering things or knowing things happened, and both going off into their own other marriages that had their own problems. Whether that just be, you know, intense arguments, name calling, infidelity, you know, just like the whole gambit of marital problems that you could have. I experienced that, but, I really say the culmination of like the first huge trauma that I was like, this is really bad, was my mom passing.
So how old were you when that happened?
I was 12. Okay. So kind of the circumstances revolving around that were my mom was trying to get full custody of my sister Jessica and I. So Jessica and I are my mom's biological kids with my father Casey. So my dad's got 7 kids. We've got a big, crazy family, but that's my full blood sibling. And my mom was trying to get full custody of us. And my mom had her own problems. She had a bad background. She was one of 6 kids. Out of those kids, there's only one alive now. So that's pretty sad because they range from like, what, 45 to like 60, or they would. So she grew up with a really bad background. And then right around like the opioid epidemic, you know, she had some pain problems. She was prescribed opioids and just very slowly, you know, she became addicted to that. And from her childhood too, I think she suffered from depression. She was diagnosed bipolar. So my mom was like, looking back at all of this, like I see things a lot differently now, but at that age, 12, I was like, okay, my mom loves us to absolute pieces. But also I knew something was happening. Something was going on. There were times where we'd just go stay with my dad for a long time. And my sister and I weren't really big fans of my dad, but our mom kind of bred us to be that way, to not really like our dad or like our stepmom. So it's a lot. There's a lot there, and it's very nuanced. But the big thing was, yeah, my mom ended up passing. So my mom had got full custody of my sister Jessica and I due to some manipulation where, you know, we went before a judge and we're like, yeah, he, you know, he's verbally abusive. You know, he throws things at us, which he'd throw like a pillow if we were standing in front of the TV. But our mom made it seem like a really big deal, you know,
and like he was throwing a lamp or something, but yeah, he might throw a pillow at you. Hey, kid.
Yeah. You know, like you're not made out of glass, you know? So right. I need you to move. And, so my mom got full custody of us. And then like 6 months before she passed, she divorced my stepdad, Lenny. If you watch the show Good Bones, Lenny's from season one and season two. And Lenny was my rock. He was, definitely who taught me how to be a man, have really good character, have incredible work ethic, and just be a very respectful person in general. My mom was cheating on him with another man, and Lenny tried his hardest to stick around, but eventually for one's own sanity and love of oneself, you got to do what you got to do.
Right.
You know, so he had moved out. Mom moved the new boyfriend in like 2 weeks later. It's like, okay, this is crazy. And then, yeah, fast forward to about when she died, it was like 2 days before she died. And, I was talking to her, she had a really tall bed and I was probably like chest high to her bed where her mattress started. And I was trying to talk to her and she kept like falling forward in her bed, just kind of nodding out, smoking a cigarette. And I'm just like, oh, this is really not good. 'Cause at 12, you're like, you're not young enough to where you just don't understand that something's going on, and neither are you old enough to have the critical comprehension skills to be like, oh, this is what that is, you know? Right. So just knew something was wrong and went and got my sister Jessica, who's younger than me, and my older sister Kaylee is like, hey, what's going on? I think my older sister Kaylee, who was 15, she had a much better idea of what was going on, but it's like, okay, I'm going to grab the house phone. I'm going to call the cops. You know, something's wrong with mom. And she took the phones, locked them in her room. And you know, looking back, like you go through all this shit that life throws at you. And one of the moments I'm really grateful for is like at 12 years old, 2 days before my mom died, after having that event, I actually picked her lock that night. It was very easy. And I just laid across from her and I just, it's like, huh, that's my mom. You know, like how fortunate I am to have her. And I knew something was wrong too. So I was like, maybe I'm not going to have her much longer. I didn't know exactly what that meant. I was like, okay. And I just, you know, shared a moment where she was sleeping and I just looked at her and I thought about my life with her and how much she loved us. And yeah, then 2 days later, I had actually gone to a friend's house because her and I had actually gotten into quite the fight. And at a young age, I'd learned how to say some really impressive, hateful stuff. So I told her she was like a bee buzzing in my ear and I, part of my language, but I wish she would fuck off at 12. And I left, went to a friend's house, and I got dropped back off the next morning, and I went to apologize to her, and I checked her bedroom. She wasn't there, like living room, kitchen. She had a trailer out back behind the house, went out there to see if she was working because that's where she ran her business from. She wasn't out there, and then we had like two cousins staying the night, and one of the five-year-old cousins, Savannah, was like, hey, she's sleeping downstairs in the laundry. And it was like,
in the laundry.
In the laundry. And I was like, okay, And you know, just that thing happened where all your hair stands up and you just know something's not right in the world right now. And I, went downstairs and, she was basically in the fetal position, just laying in the laundry pile and, just very slowly being like, mom, until, you know, reached a point of, hysterics. And, you know, as I got closer, it's like, okay, she's already pretty much turning blue and just awful, you know? And it's like,
what a terrible thing to have to see as a 12-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was.
And you had the younger kids there too, right?
Yeah. And sent them upstairs and I called my dad and my real dad who, you know, they were divorced. He worked in Kentucky. So when I called him, I was like, hey, you know, I'm pretty sure mom died. And, you know, hearing your father also have an emotional outburst, you don't typically hear that from much men. So when you do, you're like, something's really wrong.
Right.
And, you know, so I'm like, he's like, wake her up, you know, shake her. And it's like, no, you know, she's gone. And, I mean, that day changed the course of my entire life. You know, after my mom died, my older siblings came and picked me up, my dad's older kids. And then my sister and I moved in with my dad. We moved over to his house, I should say, 'cause he worked in Kentucky. So he'd be home like 1 or 2 days a week. So we moved in with my stepmom, really, who my mom really taught us to hate. So we thought that was really awful at the time. It's like, okay, we're not even living with our dad, really. He comes home 1 or 2 days a week. And then I wasn't really allowed to see Lenny anymore, who was, although he was my stepfather, he taught me a lot about being a man. So when we moved in to my dad's, it was just very different. When my dad was home, he's not so much a nurturer. That's not how he shows his love. As I've learned, as I've gotten older, he was raised a certain way and he does a lot of the same things his dad did. And I can see now those ways that he expresses his love for me. But at that time I needed like nurturing. I needed hugs. And our mom was really, really good at that. I mean, we got lullabies every night. I mean, she'd always just be like, Bubba, I can't wait to see the man you're going to be. You're going to be such a good man. I love you so much. I'm so proud of you. And going to my dad's house was just the complete kind of opposite. You know, my dad didn't really know how to talk about it. And my stepmom didn't really have the relationship with us that she could even probably broach the subject with us. So we just got sent to counselors, you know, to deal with that. And
people you didn't even know.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, after my mom died, like the next traumatic thing that's happened was like, I was so fearful some nights that I was going to die too. And I remember I would, just bang on my dad's door at like 11, 12, 1 a.m. in the morning. And he just would never open the door for me. I would just be like, I just want to sleep on your floor. Can I sleep on your floor? And he would not open that door for me. So I'd sleep outside in the hallway outside of his door to get as close as I could. And then just like a bunch of shit kept happening. You know, my mom died in November of 2005. Her sister overdosed the following year in early October. So 10 months later, one of my best friends, Ben Elo, he died of a heart arrhythmia in the shower in like eighth grade. My grandma ended up dying in a chair next to me, just like all of this.
So you had a series of tragedies.
Yeah.
That followed your mother's passing.
Yeah. Like, yeah. So mom died, her sister died 10 months later. And then, yeah, my mom's brother took his life 2 years after my mom died on her anniversary of her death. You know, so it's like there's so much stuff that I even forget all that stuff that happened in there. But what arose from that was a deep sense of protection for myself. Like at 12, you know, nobody was really protecting me, I felt like. And I was just like, okay, forget God. I had a really good relationship with God. Like, he would make small miracles happen for me all the time. I had a turtle that ran away and we were moving out of a house and I prayed for the turtle to come back. And the day we were leaving, the turtle came back. We had a dog that died from getting hit with a softball, and it was dead for like 2 minutes, and we were just praying over the dog, and the dog just started breathing again. You know, like we had a stethoscope and everything. There was no heartbeat, and the dog came back and was breathing again. So just all these little things where I was like, God loves me. He's got my back. You know, I would write in my journal, even at that age, like how much I love God. And, but, after homie went and took like four people, I was like, what is life? Yeah. Like, what is this? You know, like I often wanted to die. I was a little boy with no leadership, nobody really loving me, like, you know, thinking I had to be like a grown man. And my little sister, Jessica, who was a baby of the family, my mom's just dearest child, you know, she'd come to me crying and I'd tell her, you know, like I can't do anything. Like she's gone, you know, quit crying. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from 12 to about 14, I was depressed. I was without my mother's love. I realized I was going to be nobody's first priority anymore. There's nobody waking up thinking of me, and what goodness I'm going to do in the world, or just, you know, that I existed. And became a very dark place where I was like, I can't be friends with anybody. I can't let anybody in. They're going to die, or they're going to leave me, or they're not going to care. So that was a story, you know, I started to tell myself after my mom died. It's like, you know, if she could have got over these drugs, you know, things would be better. And it's like the drugs were worth more than me. Mm. And that dark place, yeah, it just led to a suicidal place. And there's one time I made a really good attempt at it, and I put a belt around my neck and I had locked out my arm with it. And I woke up because I passed out and my arm unlocked, mm. you know? So, and I just so was ready to be gone, which is crazy thinking now because I don't feel that way whatsoever. But, you know.
And you were just a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking, you know, 12 years old. Actually, the trauma started before you were 12 because you had all these family struggles and battles and,
yeah.
You know, marriage, divorce.
Cheating.
You know, cheating. And you know, you got new stepmom, new stepdad, then struggles and then problems there. And
yeah.
then your mom's drug problems. And yeah, you know, what you faced, unfortunately, is not all that uncommon in our country today, in our world right. today. Right. But you know, here, you don't know that. You're just a 12-year-old kid who's got all this stuff being dumped on you and nobody's loving you anymore. Nobody's caring for you and really looking out for you. And then you have all these other losses, you know, everything from, you know, another kid who's a friend of yours to other relatives. And then, you know, you reach this point where you just like, first you're probably trying to protect yourself and you withdraw. And then you're like, I just want to end it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, man, you know, so you find yourself at this point, how old were you when the attempt happened?
I believe I was 13.
13.
Yeah, 13. Okay. So, and I desperately needed something, someone. And fortunately, my brother William, my older brother William, he's about 8 years older than me. He reached out to me and he kind of really took me under his wing. So we were all raised Christian, all raised Catholic. But William in eighth grade had decided to become Buddhist. So he was kind of on this Buddhist path and, you know, by the grace of God, you know, that path that he was on somehow led to, hey, you know, my brother needs my help. I'm going to be there for him. And he was, and he really showed interest in me. He brought me along to a lot of things. I would do meditations with him, which, you know, some people have a connotation of meditation as like this. Some people think it's a bad thing, you know, mm-hmm. but meditation is also just the clearing of one's mind, letting everything just go blank for a second. And I needed things to just go blank for a second. I needed to not think about all of these awful things that are happening in life. But eventually William told me I should go on this retreat in Crestone, Colorado. And it was very different. It was run by Brahmacharinis, which are Hindu monks and nuns. Mm. And my dad was not about it, really.
He wasn't in favor.
Yeah, he was not in favor. I'd asked him to give me a plane ticket out there. He wouldn't.
How old were you again?
I was 13.
13 at this point?
Yeah, yep. Uh-huh. And you were supposed to be 18 to go to this retreat. It was supposed to cost, like, I think thousands of dollars, but I had written a letter asking for a scholarship to go for them to waive my age. And they did both those things. So then it was just getting there. And my dad's like, you know, no, not going to pay for a plane ticket for this. And, you know, I'm 13. I don't really have any money yet. So my brother William got me a Greyhound bus ticket. And at 13 by myself, I left Indianapolis on a Greyhound bus and traveled all the way to Denver, Colorado. Wow. Which was a journey in itself. We can talk about on a different podcast. But I got to Denver and then I was picked up in a van by, Hindu monks and nuns, which, you know, they've got all the white garb. Some of them have, the head dots, you know, they've got different face paint on some of them. They all have super cool names, Dayananda. I'm forgetting all the other names. Dayananda was the coolest one though. Sai Ma. Yeah, that's another one, but just very different people. And I remember that whole trip going there, just having this shell that I was refusing to break. I was like, these people aren't going to get in here. Like, this isn't going to work. I wanted it so bad, but at the same time, it's like, in order to get it, I had to be vulnerable. And that was what I deemed to be the most terrifying space I could.
Yeah, because you had pulled yourself into as a means of self-protection, and exactly. Now they're wanting you to lower those guards, right?
Like when I saw them and then they were all smiling, I'm like, do you guys not know that life is like brimstone and fire and like is awful? Like, what do you have to smile about? Like, this world's a terrible, terrible place. And that was one of my first thoughts, seeing all these people smiling at me, you know? And then, the retreat was a 2-week retreat and we would all meet and hang out for about 12 hours a day doing different things. And just slowly over that retreat, I could feel myself start opening up. What was really powerful was that these were strangers who I did not know who were just loving me. Mm. They didn't need to know much about me. I was just there and that was enough to be loved and to be looked at. And that was really powerful for me because I didn't really get that from my dad at the time. I had to go to a new school after my mom died, so I didn't have any friends who knew me, who knew when something was wrong or aching. And these people, just strangers, were doing that, you know. And the week goes on, and we're doing different exercises, and just kind of like a flower, man, you know, just like started opening up more and more. And then eventually we had one day that was an all-guy day and all-girl day. Mm-hmm. And during that all-guy day, we sat in a circle. And basically, all the men were going around expressing, like, traumas that have happened in their life. And as they're going, I'm kind of thinking some pretty mean things about them. I'm like, these aren't men. Look at these men bawling their eyes out. Mm-hmm. These big old crybabies. Because while my stepdad raised me really well, he's, like, very tough guy. He's like, you know, I'll give you something to cry about kind of guy.
Guys men don't cry.
Yeah, exactly. That was how I was raised. And, you know, so I'm watching them. I'm like, you guys are wussies, wussy, wussy. And then as it was getting closer to me, I just, like, kind of shut up. I was like, oh, shit, there's something happening. And it kept getting closer and closer. And then I was just like, oh my gosh, we're going to burst. And when it got to me, I feel the emotion right now. It's just like, everything rushed out. Just all of the pain of losing my mom, feeling so bad for the last thing I said to her, not being able to ask her for that forgiveness, for the love I wasn't receiving from my father, from those around me, feeling totally unseen by everybody and God himself. And I just cried. I just cried and I cried. And, you know, at 13, I was not a small kid. I was probably already like 170. Lifting weights and stuff. And Dayananda asked if they could pick me up and cradle me. Like,
oh, wow.
Yeah. It's like, hey, you know, this is different, but can we do this for you? And it's like, sure. And six grown men picked me up and cradled me while I just bawled my eyes out, just totally lost my ever loving mind in the tears and the pain and the hurt. And Dayananda was just standing right above me, just looking into my eyes, you know, just nothing but compassion and love, and just telling me like, it's okay. You can let all of this go. And I did. And in that moment, I really did. And it's really from that epicenter of time that the whole trajectory of my life changed. Something that just deeply ingrained into me that day was like, these strangers I've known for no more than 2 weeks loved me in such a fashion that they loved me in such a fashion that nobody else could, you know, or did at that time. That the love of a stranger, if you just hold space and you give someone that love, you can change their life.
Yeah.
And that day I found out that love is the most powerful antidote to whatever problem you face, to whatever is going on in your life. And after that day, it became a mission of mine. It became a daily meditation, something that just I have constantly filtered through since I was 13, of like, how do I be this love to other people? How do I help the other hurt little boys that are inside grown men, or the little kids inside women, or just everybody? How do I become in tune with that, to where when I meet a stranger, like, I don't want you to think I don't know you. Like, there's something that exists in you that is the same as me. And since then, it has been that meditation of like, how do I love people better? Mm-hmm. How do I help them heal those traumas? Because if that retreat didn't happen, I don't know what would have happened to me.
When you look at the course that you were on,
yeah,
you know, the road that you were headed down, and you know, there's just not a lot of good outcomes ahead of you.
No.
And it took these strangers, these men who just loved you.
Yeah.
And it changed the whole trajectory of your life.
It did. Yeah.
So what were the key things? I mean, I think first of all, from listening to you and seeing the emotion in your eyes, and in your voice, I think maybe the first thing is they actually saw you.
Yeah.
Right.
I felt seen.
You felt seen. It's like you hadn't felt seen since your mom was gone.
Yeah.
Right. And you finally felt seen, and not just seen, but heard. They were listening to you, really listening, not just, you know, half-hearted or in one ear, out the other ear. They were really listening.
Yeah.
And then they actually took action on that, right? And pulled you in.
Yeah, they did. They just pulled me right in. And it's that deep kind of listening, that deep kind of being seen. It's like someone's seen through you. You know, it's when someone else takes your pain or your emotion and they make it their own too, you know, and I think we kind of forget how powerful our emotions are, but you know, just sharing this story with you and that vulnerability, it's like you can feel it too.
Oh yeah.
To some extent.
Oh yeah.
And that shared vulnerability is powerful. And it's something that bonds people, because everyone's fucking, or sorry, apologies, Christian podcast.
Beep.
A beep. But everyone is terrified of something in their life and they're afraid to let go. And so when you can express something to someone else,
yeah,
where it's like that fear or that vulnerability and they meet you.
Yeah.
Does that feel good?
Yeah. Yeah, there's people all over the place who feel invisible.
Yeah.
Right. They're maybe they don't have the depth of the traumas that you had. And some of them may have traumas that go even more deeply than what you experienced.
Absolutely.
But they're all around us. There are people who feel invisible. They feel like there's nobody who cares to hear their story. I know this because sometimes I'll just start talking. I'll start talking to somebody. It might be in a restaurant or it might be someplace. And the next thing I know, they're telling me their life story.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And why? Is it because I'm like a counselor? No. It's because I cared enough to listen to them.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
It's amazing what we could do with other people and helping them if we would take the time to have some empathy and see them and hear them and embrace them.
I absolutely agree. And I think we get so far away from that because we move so fast now. Mm-hmm. We move so fast through life. Like, technology is speeding along. We're working a lot. We're always trying to get someplace, we're living in a very material world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from that retreat and that experience and this meditation over the past 15 or so years, you know, we're not the physical being, you know, we are a spiritual being having a physical, experience, you know, right. And, I really do believe like our purpose here is to love, you know, it's like, it's nice to have these material things, but I found that whenever I root myself in love and I go out and I say, I'm going to be a kind, compassionate, loving person. I'm going to be empathetic. I'm going to be a good listener. I'm going to be graceful. I'm going to be merciful. And when I have that conversation with myself about who that I say that I am each day, my life has turned out beautifully. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no other path that I feel like I could take or that people should take. It's like, if you focus on the most genuine thing you can, which is loving people, loving yourself, and then that's where you start your path and you go out from there, what direction can be wrong?
Right.
Where can you go wrong in that direction? You know, if you step over to something else because of greed, and say you start a business with your best friend, and then you've got someone who wants to make a deal with you where you're going to cut your best friend out. It's like, okay, you made some more money, but maybe you just lost your best friend.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like whenever an action's rooted in love and you really know it and you really think about it and you sit on it and you be patient with it, you don't immediately respond in anger and stuff, you can find that answer that's rooted in love. Mm-hmm. And that's been my experience, especially the past 2 or 3 years. So, you know, I'm 29 and I share a lot of this stuff about love to people. They're like, well, it's not easy. And it's like, absolutely right. It is not easy whatsoever. There are times where I want to explode or say some hurtful things. So, but it's a practice.
Yeah, it's a practice. And it's something that you continue to grow in. It takes intentional effort. And unfortunately, we live in a society, I think, where most people think that love is just an emotion.
Yeah.
And it's really not. It's kind of a decision to care about the people around you and care enough to actually take some action on that care. As we record this, it's Sunday afternoon. I went to church this morning, and the minister at our church, he did a fine sermon, focused on sin. And, I'm okay with an occasional sermon on sin. I think we need to understand what that is, and that I'm good with that. But the thing I kept thinking is that sin almost, I can't really think of a sin that doesn't come out of selfishness.
Right.
And if you're focused on love and loving the person next to you, loving the people around you, loving your enemy, loving your neighbor, loving your brother, loving people, that's the opposite of selfishness.
Yeah.
And if we could just learn to set aside that selfishness and to love the person next to us, so many of our problems go away.
Yeah. I just had a big thought. I'm going to try to get it in, but it's like, people think it's harder to probably focus on loving other people than being selfish. You know, a lot of the times we probably choose selfishness because it's the easier path, or so we think. But once you get good at loving other people and you really focus in on that and that stuff starts happening, you'll see the way God is rewarding you.
Yeah.
You know, like, God permeates everything, and he's always putting light posts out. He's always doing something to show you that he is present, you know? So it's like, a lot of the times people will be like, oh, well, that's the harder path. I don't want to take that harder path. Well, you don't know what the price of not taking that harder path is. You know, so if you focus on yourself and your physical needs when you're, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60, maybe you love that. It's amazing. But when you get to 80, 90 and all you have is a really nice house and a really nice car with nobody in it,
yeah,
you're going to
realize. You're all alone and nobody likes you and nobody.
Exactly. Yeah. You're going to realize that you took the harder path because in the end you are going to suffer way more because yeah, you had those nice things, but you had nobody to love.
Yeah.
You had nobody to love you. Yeah. And as humans, like we're social beings, we're social creatures. We yearn to be loved and seen by other people, even just strangers. You know, most people, if a stranger came up and said something mean, it would still matter to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because we want to be loved. We want to love others. We want to be accepted. And yeah, we're so fast paced. We miss the spiritual side of ourselves so often, you know, like, going to church on Sunday just isn't enough. You know, it's like church, Christianity, any religion kind of reminds me of my Spanish class. My Spanish teacher would always tell me, it's like, yeah, we're going to learn Spanish for an hour here, but if you don't do it outside of this classroom, you're not going to learn Spanish.
And that's ding, that's ding, ding.
Yeah. You know, but that's a lot. What happens is like you get your dose on Sunday of some, you know, God goodness, and then it gets missed throughout the week. It doesn't get put into practice, you know, but if you put that thing into practice first, if you put love into practice first and you hone that skill and you rewire your brain, like your life just becomes better.
Yeah,
it really does. If anyone wants to, you know, talk to me about that, I'm 100% sure of this. So, but your life will, because a lot of us also at the same time, we take our self-esteem and we base it on worldly things. We base it on money. We base it on status. We base it on how we're viewed by our family, how we're viewed by our friends, on power, you know. And the thing about all of those external things is those external things can change. You can lose your power. You can lose your status. You can lose the esteem of your family. And once you lose all those things, guess what also changes? Your self-worth.
Right.
So you're basing it on something that is fleeting where it's like, well, what can you root yourself in as young as you can, as soon as you can, what can you root yourself in that doesn't change? And that thing is one, love. And then what is love? What are the virtues of it? Grace, mercy, compassionate, you know, non-judgmental.
Love is empathetic. Patient. Love is kind.
Yeah.
Love,
all the Beatitudes.
Yeah.
You know, so if you root yourself in that, it's like when anything happens externally to you, you lose your job, you lose your status, you lose esteem. How you view yourself doesn't change though. Cause it's like, and I practice this right now cause I struggle with it too. I'm like, but am I a loving person? Am I kind? Am I trustworthy? Yeah. Okay. I'm a little weird, but am I all these really important things? You know? And it's like, yeah, no, I am these things. I know I'm these things. And I find myself getting swayed and moved a lot less and when you get moved a lot less by the things that are external to you, you will focus more on your internal, and from that you will blossom beautiful things out into your life and the life of others. Cause it's the swaying back and forth that, it distracts you, mm-hmm. You know, when you get that burst of anger, yeah. I had a little monologue there for a second.
No, that was good. That was good. I like that monologue. Well, I spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about how love is not a program. And it's, you know, like you were talking about, you know, going to church on Sunday, you get your dose, and then you go off and do whatever the rest of the week. And it's really not about a program or, you know, checking a checklist, but it's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, loving other people is a lifestyle. The thing that I was struck by when you were telling your story is, you know, you said you were raised Christian. You're around a lot of people who claim Christianity, claim Christ.
Yeah.
And yet through all that trauma, you had to go all the way to Denver, away from Indianapolis, which is a couple of thousand miles away.
Yeah.
On a bus by yourself. to be with a bunch of men that you've never met before, who's not even the same religion as you.
Correct.
In order to learn what love really is and feel like you were seen and heard and people cared.
Yes.
And I think for me, this is a message. This is a lesson for me, and it's a lesson for my listeners that, hey, you know, pay attention to the people around you. You know, don't make the kid next door have to go on a bus ride halfway across the country for somebody to notice that they're in pain. Right. Yeah. And talk to the server at the restaurant and listen, you know, care about what's going on with the people around you. And I think the other message is that love is not just a Christian thing.
No.
Right. We're not very good at it, honestly. I'll say that. And if somebody out there gets mad, fine, get mad at me. But as Christians, we're frankly these days not very good at it. No. We're really good at saying what we're against, and we're really good at taking political stands, but we're not very good at actually loving people who are hurting. And you know, I'm going to ask the listeners out there to just mull that over and think about that, because I think what Jesus wanted us to be known for was our love.
Yeah.
And not our politics.
Absolutely.
So I think you started to say something that I kept going with my own monologue.
No, you're good. I was chomping at the bit for this, cause I had like a revelation a few years ago, just cause I'm constantly meditating on this love thing. And it's like, well, you know, as Christians, what was so powerful about Jesus? You know, whether you are a Christian or whether you're not, because there's other religions that respect Jesus to heavens. Mm-hmm. You know, but what was it about Jesus? What was it about, you know, Martin Luther King Jr.? What was it about Gandhi? Like, what made all of these men so pronounced in the world and someone worth following? And one of the things I noticed growing up as Christians is we are very judgmental. We do talk a lot about what we're against,
right?
Which is easier to do than to love the things or the people that we are against, which is what we're told to do.
Right.
You know, and I think what was so powerful about Jesus, and for your listeners, I really want this to sink in. Like, the thing that was so powerful about Jesus was that he focused on his light so much that it shined a brightness that it didn't matter who or what somebody did or who they were in their life or how long. Like, they could come to him and say, hey, you know, I'm a prostitute, or hey, I did this awful thing. And Jesus really didn't take much time to be like, oh, wow, you really messed up. Like, you got to change your path. He said, cool, come follow me. And that was it, because he focused on that light so much that he didn't need to judge them. Because what happens when we cast judgment on someone is we're putting them in a box of what we believe they are. And guess what most people do, because they don't know how to do differently? They accept the box that you put them in. Your words are incredibly powerful, especially as Christians, when you're speaking to other people. When you tell someone what they are or who you believe they are, one, you're putting yourself as an arbiter of right and wrong with your very limited time here. You know, so it's like, okay, maybe there needs to be a little bit of an ego check there. Because do you really know best? Like, some things, yeah, but some other things, maybe you don't understand. And if we took a step back just to shine our bright light, focus on love, that's how you attract people. Mm-hmm. You don't tell them like, hey, you're messing up. That person's going to get defensive.
They probably already know they're messing up. They don't really need somebody else to point it out.
Exactly. Right? Hey, Mike, I love you. I see that something's going on in your life right now, and I want to express this to you because I know you can reach a higher potential good. And it hurts me that you're not doing so right now. And if you ever want to talk about it, I just want you to know I love you and I have time for you.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
When do we talk like that though?
We don't.
And that's part of the problem. Like, when we get angry, like, all of our emotions, believe it or not, they stem from a place of I care. Like, when we're irritated about something, why are we irritated? Because we care about something.
Right.
Why are we angry? Because we care about something. But what happens is, we've lost the language to communicate that in a loving, vulnerable way.
Right.
Jesus was really good at that.
Yeah.
You know, he would speak from his heart. And, you know, when someone disappoints us, we're more focused on making them feel the punishment of our emotion than we are in loving them to help repair what's going on. And sorry, I'm bouncing all over the place, but I've thought about love for so long and I have so many grand ideas I want to share. It's so hard. But yeah, it's, you know, Jesus, yeah, his light was bright and he just let his light do the work.
Yeah.
He didn't have to do as much talking about it.
And I actually spoke about this on my last podcast. I talked a little bit about where Jesus said, "Let your light shine before men."
Yeah.
That they can see your good deeds and then praise your Father in heaven. I might have butchered that up a little bit, but it's pretty close.
Yeah. It sounded really good.
It's like you know, it's like we're like a little lampstand, you know, with our light shining out, the love of God flowing through us and to other people. And when we refuse to reflect that love, then, you know, I think we lose our lampstand.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, we're definitely losing our purpose. And so I appreciate so much your being willing to come on and share your story and have this conversation. It's been, you know, it's been a journey for me.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up, Thaddeus, I didn't come from a church background. I came from a home that was, no, it's pretty rough. I mean, a lot of the stuff that you described that you went through as a child, some of my nieces and nephews went through that. They, I mean, that kind of same kind of stuff, broken homes, abuse at in the home, lots of really hateful language flying around, alcoholism, drug use, a lot of stuff. I didn't have that in my direct household, but I also didn't go to church, but my nieces and nephews did experience all that through my brothers and my sister and their relationships. It was just, it's rough to see all that. Yeah. And so I have a little bit of firsthand knowledge of seeing people experience that, in their lives. And it took for me, I don't know where I was headed. You know, I don't know where I was headed in my life. But it took the outreach of a really kind neighbor to see this little kid next door in this house that is a mess. Now, I don't mean dirty mess. I mean, just, emotionally and relationally it was a mess. She saw that kid over there and she took me under her wing. And it, like with you, I didn't have to go to Denver, but it changed the trajectory of my life.
Yeah.
Right. And I have no idea where I would be today, but it probably wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be in a whole lot, probably bigger mess.
Right.
So it hadn't been for that person reaching out to me.
I call that looking for the light posts. Like if you're listening to this podcast right now, at the end of it, you know, no matter how hard your life is or how good it is right now, take a moment and do something called look for the light posts and look through, retrace your life back to the beginning and all the hard things you went through. And there's different things that have happened where God, the universe has put a light post there for you. Yeah. You know, my brother was my light post. You know, your neighbor was one of your light posts. Mm-hmm. So it's like we have days where we just don't know how we're going to make it through or get through. And it's like, but look, your whole life, there has been a light post waiting for you to see it. Yeah.
So there are light posts out there for you.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can be the light post for someone else.
You can always be the light post.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's be light post, man.
Absolutely.
Let's be light post.
I would love to be the best light post, the brightest light post. Like, yeah, I'd love that. And I got a question for you actually.
Sure.
You know, cause we've talked about love a few times now. And I feel like once you start a meditation on love, there's some things that are just kind of like, you almost objectively experience along learning about it where it's like, okay, love, you know, meditating. It's like, oh, I need to be really vulnerable. And when I'm vulnerable, it does this. And like things kind of unlock and you get kind of aha moments. Does that make sense at all?
Oh, yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. I think I've, I don't know if I'm on exactly the same wavelength of what you're talking about, but you know, I've definitely had some aha moments. My first aha moment with love was really probably about 2018. I didn't grow up in church, but I've been in church for most of my life after about seventh grade.
Yeah.
And went to Bible college for a couple of years. I've taught church. I've been in leadership at church and basically I was very entrenched for a long time with all the things that, you know, church people are entrenched with. Right. And then, about 2018, I picked up a book. It was called Love First, by a preacher in Atlanta, Georgia named Don McLaughlin. I actually had him on. He did an interview with me last year.
Well, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So he's a cool guy. And so I read his book and I was like, oh my gosh, it's like some blinders fell off. Right. Cause I started seeing, that's when I really started seeing love in the Bible. Right. Yeah. Cause you know, Bible been something important to me. I went to Bible college. I read Bible a lot. I taught Bible and all this stuff. And all of a sudden I started seeing love in the Bible and realized it was really all over the place. And then what happens is that as we, as Christians, what we do is we read right over the top of it. We kind of, in America anyway, we see love as an emotion and it's kind of this foo-foo thing. You know, it's kind of like you said, you know, you were talking about, you know, real men don't cry kind of thing that your dad would have. It's like, you know, we read over it like it's something fluffy, like it's an adjective.
Right.
But the reality is that love is really interlaced all the way through the New Testament, all the way through that area. And I started seeing it. And that's when my blinders, and I had my first aha moment and blinders kind of fell off and I started seeing it. Since then, I've had a whole slew of little ones where it's like, oh, wow. So that's how that works. Oh, you know, it's like, struggling with sin in your life. You know, there's certain things that men struggle with and it's like, I can't seem to stop this. And it's not about just, you know, I figured out it's not about stopping something. It's about doing something positive.
Right.
Right. So if I stop being selfish, I won't be as prone to doing this other thing that's been driving me crazy.
Right.
Right. And so you start learning these things and seeing how they impact, your life and change your lifestyle.
Right.
And change the way that you interact with other people. Probably my biggest struggle these days is being impatient with people who really don't see the importance of love.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, can't you see this? I just want to go grab them and shake them.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of my harder trials that I recently just had is, my little sister, Jessica. So Jessica is less than a year younger than me. She's my only full biological sibling from my mom. And like I said, I'm 29. So she's 28 right now. And probably around 16, 17, she started her drug usage and has been off and on, off and on. And over the course of 15 years from her being off and on with three girls now, you know, that are with different family members. I mean, over the years, she's ditched me when I've taken her rides to go to the grocery store. She's probably gotten me for like 15 grand worth of things. So just over and over again. Something my heart always tells me though, is like, I'm a kind, compassionate person and it doesn't matter how many times she does this, you know, I have to keep showing up. And recently she just got clean for 5.5 months. Mm. And Mike, she was trying so hard. She really was. She was showing up to all of her counselor meetings. She was taking all of her DCS drug tests, like everything. She was passing, but she had just been in that life for so long and she could feel herself slipping. She got her methadone dosage bumped up to try to cut the craving. And she just turned back, you know. Oh. You know, and it sucks, but, the selfish thing to do there would have been to just not care about it or worry about it. Cause now I have this love that's still invested in it and it hurts. But going on this path where you realize things and you're going to hit those struggles, it's like, but this is one of those things that ultimately it's like, well, as I get older And no matter what age you are, listener, as you get older, you'll look back and be like, where are the moments that I missed loving someone? Mm-hmm. Where did I not do the right thing? Because I think regret's going to be the worst thing that happens to us when we get old. Like, what did we not do? Mm-hmm. You know, so with her, it's like, okay, that's a struggle, but that's what love is, you know, and it'd be easier not to do it. It would, but ultimately it unlocks other things in your life.
Sometimes love is painful.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's as humans, we hurt one another.
Yeah.
It's what we do. Mm-hmm. The only thing that can mitigate that is the fact that we love one another.
Yeah.
But when we love one another, then, you know, we're going to be vulnerable.
Yep.
You know, gotta be. And we're going to get hurt.
Yeah.
But there's no better alternative. You know, and we're only going to make a difference in people's lives when we really do love.
Yeah. Have you, there's this incredible quote by C.S. Lewis. I'm going to see if I can pull it up real quick. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Take your time. I can always cut out a dead air if I need to.
Okay. You might not need to. I keep it pretty close to the top. Oh, here we go. Yeah, we got it. So this is a C.S. Lewis quote, and it's from his book, The Four Loves. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful. It's about, you know, what would your life look like if you didn't love? What would it be? So here it goes. There is no safe investment. To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to be sure of keeping it intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. Your heart will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The only place outside of heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers and perturbations of love is hell.
Ouch.
Yeah. And yeah, it's like when you extrapolate that out where it's like, is it harder to actually love? You know what's even harder? Living in an existence that's hell. Because that's the opposite of love, you know? And
living in an existence where there is no love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unimaginable. That's why we have to tell everyone, Mike.
But we got to keep this message going, right?
Yeah. And even like while we're talking to each other, it's like, we know you, the listener, are there too. And it's just, you can't hear it in my voice, but it's like, I love you guys. Like, I'm here with Mike today because one, he wanted to talk about love and I like talking about love. Mike's my friend, but also it's like, this is something that pushes me forward is to share this with you, the listeners, is that I don't really know you, but I love you. And I want the best for your life. And I want all of the happiness for your life. I want you to laugh. I want you to cry happy tears. I want you to make it through painful things and realize that there's this goodness. There's this love that is always pushing you from behind, trying to help you get through whatever you're getting through. So at the end of your long life, you know that you've lived a fulfilled one. I want to love you to that point. And life moves fast and like we kind of forget that, but you know, listener, that's what I want for you. That's why I'm here today talking to Mike, is because I don't know you, but we're the same, you know, we're all the same in God's eyes and we all have a want to live a beautifully happy life. And this is me trying to do my part to help you live that beautiful, happy life.
Awesome. Thaddeus, thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for being on the show. And listeners out there, I appreciate you listening. If you have any, feel free to email me at michael@authormicheldecamp.com. If you have any comments or messages for Thaddeus, feel free to send them over to me. I'll be happy to pass them along. I'm always encouraged when I get to talk to Thaddeus for a little bit. So I appreciate him being on. Appreciate you guys listening. And we'll catch you again on the next Love Mentalism podcast. Take care, folks.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Love Mentalism Podcast. You're welcome to send comments to the host at the following email address, michael@authormicheldecamp.com. Michael is available for limited speaking engagements, both live and virtual. Reach out for details. The music for this podcast was written and performed by Xander Fadley. You can find his work at www.xanderfadley.com. The logo was created by Blue Sign Concepts, Indianapolis. Executive producer is Bill Whitehair. Please come back for the next episode of the Love Mentalism Podcast.